From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Robert Young directed the new film Triumph of the Spirit. It stars Willem Dafoe as a Greek boxer imprisoned in a Nazi death camp. On today's Fresh Air, Young tells us about shooting on location in Auschwitz. Also, we meet Bud Schulberg, who wrote some of the most recited lines in film history. I could have been a contender. I could have had class. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward introduces us to the music of New Orleans bluesman Rabbit Brown. And book critic John Leonard reviews Ann Beattie's new novel. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Sharon Green. The Soviet Communist Party's Central Committee plenum will resume debate tomorrow on President Gorbachev's proposal to end the party's monopoly on power. Despite extensive and heated discussion today, key questions remain unresolved. On Capitol Hill, a group of senators have called for a cutoff of U.S. aid to El Salvador. The senators, all Democrats, say 10 years and billions of dollars of U.S. assistance have created neither freedom nor reform in the violence-plagued Central American country. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
Over the past 10 years, El Salvador has been the fifth largest recipient of U.S. military and economic aid. Yet fighting between the American-backed government and communist rebels continues unabated, and there are questions about President Alfredo Cristiani's control over the military. The senators, including Edward Kennedy and John Kerry of Massachusetts and Barbara Mikulski of Maryland, say it's time to pull the plug on further U.S. aid. Senator Mikulski compared El Salvador to Eastern Europe.
Certainly, if Jaruzelski can change, so can the El Salvador military. Certainly, if we can talk about the rights to express and organize in Moscow, we can talk about it in El Salvador.
The senators say a cutoff of aid should be coupled with renewed efforts to negotiate a settlement of the civil war under the auspices of the United Nations. This is Brian Naylor at the Capitol.
Oliver North's lawyers today asked a federal appeals court to reverse North's conviction on three felony counts stemming from the Iran-Contra affair. Details from NPR's Nina Totenberg.
Defense lawyer Barry Simon argued that when Congress granted North limited immunity, it set up an impossible situation. No matter what the precautions taken by the prosecutor, Simon argued, North's, quote, coerced confession was broadcast to every corner of the nation. It was so pervasive, said the defense lawyer, that no prosecutor, no juror, no witness could be unaffected by the testimony, and therefore North was denied his constitutional right not to incriminate himself. The three-judge appellate panel seemed most concerned about witnesses who'd been exposed to North's congressional testimony. Prosecutor Gerard Lynch responded that all the witnesses who testified against North on the charges he was convicted of testified first in front of the grand jury before North testified on Capitol Hill, and they didn't change their stories afterwards. Still, the appeals court panel seemed troubled, and one judge suggested that the panel might face a choice between reversing North's conviction outright and sending the case back to the trial judge for further inquiry on the question of tainted testimony. I'm Nina Totenberg in Washington.
By a vote of 289 to 132, the House of Representatives tonight passed legislation that establishes automatic voter registration for people getting driver's licenses. The measure also sets up procedures for voter registration by mail. Prices were lower on Wall Street today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell more than 16 points to close at 2606.31. Declines led advances 3-2 in volume of 134 million shares. This is NPR News. Jailed black South African nationalist leader Nelson Mandela today praised President F.W. de Klerk for courageous and bold racial reforms. But Mandela said more must be done before negotiations can begin on power sharing with the country's black majority. Mandela's reaction was relayed to reporters at the minimum security prison by anti-apartheid church leader Reverend Alan Bosack. Bosack said during their three-hour meeting, Mandela specifically called on Pretoria to lift the nearly four-year-old state of emergency and release all political prisoners. Bosack said Mandela would accept his own freedom whether or not the government meets all the conditions black leaders have spelled out. An underground electrical explosion in New York City has injured 10 railroad workers and is causing problems for rail commuters using New York's Grand Central Station. Dick Henschliff of member station WNYC has more.
The blast occurred shortly after 12:30 in a railroad tunnel underneath the Waldorf Astoria Hotel just a few blocks away from Grand Central. Metro North spokesman Dan Brucker.
A tamping ballast machine had cut into a 600-volt power feeder cable that goes to the third rail. It caused not only an explosion and fire, but also excessive smoke.
The fire was put out by 4 dozen firefighters within an hour, but not before smoke seeped into the Waldorf Astoria lobby as well as Grand Central. 10 railroad workers received treatment for smoke inhalation, and 2 firefighters suffered slight injuries. Metro North says limited service has now resumed for the railroad's 85,000 commuters. For National Public Radio, I'm Dick Hinchliffe in New York.
West German Chancellor Helmut Kohl expressed support today for immediate talks with East Germany on setting up a currency between the two countries. Politicians in both countries are calling for immediate moves toward monetary and economic union to save East Germany's shattered economy and to stop the continuing flow of East German citizens to the West. I'm Sharon Green, reporting for National Public Radio News in Washington.
I'm Terry Gross. This is Fresh Air. The new movie Triumph of the Spirit is based on the true story of a Greek boxer, Salomo Arush. He and his family in 1943 were deported to the Nazi death camps Auschwitz-Birkenau. For the entertainment of the SS officers, he was forced to box more than 200 opponents. He beat them all. As the winner, he was often given extra bread. The loser was usually sent to the gas chamber. Willem Dafoe stars as the boxer. Robert Loggia plays his father. Edward James Olmos is a gypsy capo. Triumph of the Spirit is directed by my guest Robert M. Young. Young got his start in film in the 1950s, making documentaries. In 1964, he collaborated on his first feature, Nothing But a Man, about a black couple in the South. But it took over 10 more years before he established himself as a feature film director. His movies include One Trick Pony, which Paul Simon wrote and starred in, Extremities, which featured Farrah Fawcett as a rape victim who captures and tortures her rapist, and Dominic and Eugene, which starred Tom Hulce, Ray Liotta, and Jamie Lee Curtis. Triumph of the Spirit is the first feature film that was shot on location at Auschwitz. I asked Robert Young if he had mixed feelings about shooting in the death camp, if he felt maybe he should leave it as is and not use it as a movie set.
I think I did have the feelings that we were in a very hallowed place, and that it would be sacrilegious to do anything that was wrong. But I felt very strongly that if we were in touch with the truth to the degree that we could really understand it and bring it into film terms, that was a wonderful thing to be doing. And I felt very much in touch, let's say, with those voices that had been stilled there. I mean, I think people who had been there would have been happy that we were there to tell about their story. I mean, even terrible things that happen, these things should not be lost to us, because it's human experience, and we should learn from it and be able to go on to do something about it. And I think that there were very, very important reasons, as far as I'm concerned, for being there and why it was right to be there.
I think Triumph of the Spirit, your film, is a fine film, but I'll confess to you, I was very emotionally resistant to it in the mm-hmm. beginning, and I was thinking to myself, why am I putting myself through this? I mean, I've read a lot of literature about the Holocaust. I've seen a number of films about the Holocaust. I don't think I'm in danger of forgetting it. And even if I see another movie, I still won't know any firsthand what it really was. I'll still just be an observer of an enactment of the experience. Did you? And I was wondering if you went through that when you were deciding to do the movie.
Well, let me ask you some questions, because mm-hmm. one of the things that I tried to do was to make the film very experiential, mm-hmm. so that when you came into Auschwitz on that train and those people came off, that you were with them, and you began to be, you were buttressed by the forces of the camp and tossed around and go through this kind of experience. See, I think that there is one can say, and a lot of people do, well, I know about this. I don't need to subject myself to it. What I think is that I think that the empathetic relationship that is formed between you and the characters, so that you are able, you participate with them, you are able to love them, and see from and just feel in a more compassionate and poignant way what people go through in this process of where they are dehumanized. And I think that the process of being in touch is a process that makes the viewer himself more aware of of what that process of dehumanization does. I mean, look, what happened, happened. I think we have to try to learn from it. But it seems to me the way to give a meaning to these kind of things, like the experience of Auschwitz, is to take it into our own lives, because I think there's some of that hardening in all of us.
What are some of the things you wanted to show in this movie that you thought hadn't been shown before, or emotions that you wanted to show that you think hadn't been dealt with before in movies or literature of the Holocaust?
Well, I think that what happens in the story of Salomo is that it's a story of a survivor, not a hero. Someone who desperately wants to hang on to life and you know, becomes a witness. It's not... the personal, the triumph is really, of the spirit, is not some kind of a joyous kind of triumph. I don't see how that can happen in the face of the 11 million people who were killed in the camps.
Did you mean the title, Triumph of the Spirit, to stand as a contrast to the Leni Riefenstahl movie Triumph of the Will?
Yes, very much so.
Explain the contrast.
Well, Triumph of the Will is a film celebrating sort of the march of fascism, of Nazism. It's a film that is very much about the surface of the face of Nazism, and as seen in these fantastically beautiful images of stormtroopers and troops marching, and you have this sense of glory and overwhelming power. And this is very different than that. This is about those people who he you know, wanted so ruthlessly to destroy, and the film is just by bringing you close and to Willem and his father and his brother and some other people to allow you to see them in the context of this camp and understand from their point of view what this kind of nightmare was like.
Robert Young is my guest, and he directed the new film Triumph of the Spirit, which stars Willem Dafoe as a boxer in the death camp Auschwitz, and he survives, and it's based on a true story. You had Willem Dafoe in the leading role in this, and it's ironic. You know, he was just crucified in The Last Temptation of Christ, and
right.
Now he has to live through the Holocaust in your film.
He takes on tough ones.
Yeah. What's he like to direct? I mean, he seems to be the kind of character who really anguishes about a role, you know, who will really go through extremes to get into the role.
Mm-hmm. That's right. He's a completely dedicated actor. For example, for this role, he had to train as a boxer, and he worked out for 3 hours a day for about 3 months before the film started, with a wonderful trainer named Teddy Atlas, who had helped train Mike Tyson. And Teddy is a brilliant trainer and worked very hard with Willem and choreographed the fight scenes. In fact, Teddy Atlas is the second fighter who Willem fights against. And that kind of discipline that was required to become a boxer is enormous, and it's about, of course, the physical acts, but it also it requires a very strong mental attitude, because boxing in the end is really when two people are pitted in the ring, it's also about it's about their character and about their will and a determination not to lose, and that's the way that Willem is.
There are a lot of boxing scenes in the movie. Willem Dafoe has to fight other inmates of Auschwitz. It's a kind of fight to the death almost, because the loser gets sent off to the ovens, and they're fighting for the entertainment of the SS. You've never directed boxing scenes before, right?
No, I never have.
What were some of the considerations?
I did one, and I made a film called Short Eyes, and I did a boxing scene in that, mm-hmm. Kind of a rough kind of a fight. But this one was really... The credit for the boxing, the way it was done, physically done really goes to Teddy Atlas. He's brilliant at that. But I decided to shoot it in such a way, not by using camera magic, so that you could cut and make a fight seem thrilling. They had to strike the blows. They had to know what was going to happen. If Willem didn't duck and slide at a certain point, he'd be hit. And that happened. Their timings had to be perfect. And they fought with a lot of vigor. So it was not easy. They got hit. They got hurt. But it was the way we all wanted to do it, to make it as realistic as possible. And Teddy showed the film to a number of boxing, sports writers, and they said it was the most accurate and authentic kind of boxing that they'd ever seen on film.
Let's take a short break, then we'll talk some more. My guest is film director Robert Young, and his latest film is Triumph of the Spirit. It's set in Auschwitz and stars Willem Dafoe and Edward James Olmos. Young's earlier films include Dominic and Eugene, Short Eyes, The Ballad of Gregorio Cortez, and Nothing But a Man. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Film director Robert Young is my guest. Now, you started off doing documentaries. Was there a certain phoniness in many theatrical films that you felt as a result of filming so many real-life sequences, the phoniness that you tried to keep out of your own theatrical releases when you started making them?
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's very true. Making documentaries it means that you're, at least the style of documentaries that I'm used to making or making in the past, was, I'd come into some kind of situation that was ongoing. It might have been the sit-in movement in the South, and I'd be, right in the middle of, crowds and all kinds of things happening, and the kind of reality that I experienced was something that I really wanted to bring into my films. I felt that a lot of feature films, although I enjoyed them, I love movies, had a kind of antiseptic kind of feeling, and that even the camera work often was sort of very predictable. You'd see the master shot, and then you'd go in for the close-ups, and there was a kind of operational mode in it. And I found from having been in situations where things were happening fast. I mean, I've been in filming in revolutions and sharks and man-eating tiger and catching wild elephants. I mean, I've been with nomads, and I've had a great time making films. And the way that things happened, the unpredictable way, is one of the things that I wanted to bring to the staging I ever made narrative films, feature films.
I think one common flaw with a lot of theatrical films, especially psychological films, is that people reveal themselves through these elaborate speeches about what they believe and right and wrong, and they have these sudden revelations about the past that they make speeches about. What are ways of getting around that? Because people don't talk like that in real life.
Right. Well, I think that that's one of the things that television seems to promote a lot too. Things are directed toward being made explicit, as if the audience doesn't understand what's going on underneath the surface. And what really is the most interesting thing, and the thing that I'm interested in, is really what is going on underneath the surface. There's very little dialogue, for example, in Triumph of the Spirit. And I try to let it be enigmatic. I let people project onto Willem what he thinks about the fact that he's fighting with someone else, and that person's life, if that person loses, he has a responsibility, and that he helped destroy that person. On the other hand, if he loses, he himself will be destroyed. I don't think that one needs to talk about that.
You usually don't write the screenplay that you're directing. Have you ever had to rewrite a film because there was too much speech-making in it, and you thought that the idea could better be conveyed more visually?
Well, in Triumph of the Spirit, there's a scene where Willem's father is saying goodbye to him, he's been selected, we had a couple of pages of dialogue, and the scene on the screen, if you remember, there's not one word spoken.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's much more effective that way. In the scene where he meets Allegra during an air raid in a steel mill.
This is his lover who's also in Auschwitz.
Yes, and that scene, again, we had a couple of pages of dialogue written, and I sort of like dreamed the scene, and the lines were, "If I live, I'll find you," and she says, "I'll be there," and that's all there was. That's the only dialogue in that whole scene. So yes, very often I try to boil it down to letting the people experience the scene and let the words be spoken in the audience's, you know, in their heads, in a sense. Let them get the insight and not have to be told.
In your years as a documentary filmmaker, you spent a few years making movies for the NBC documentary series White Paper, and that took you to sit-ins in the South, to Angola, to a Sicilian slum. Now, I understand after you made your film in Angola that the CIA tried to recruit you.
Yes, that's right.
Mm-hmm. Why did they choose you, and how did they approach you?
Well, I don't know how they chose me, but when I came back from Angola in 1961, I went, sort of sneaked in across from the Congo, it was then the Congo, not Zaire, into northern Angola where the war had started. And there were about 50,000 refugees that poured into the Congo, and the United Nations was trying to find out what was happening, and reporters, no one was allowed in. The Portuguese would not allow anyone in. So I sneaked in with a friend, Charlie Dorkins, and we walked 400 miles through northern Angola and came out with this first story of the war. When we made the film, there was great interest in on the part of the CIA in trying to find out what I knew about the morale of the people who were in the revolt, what kind of weapons they had, and you know, what I had seen. And I was, of course, very interested in telling them what I had seen. I had seen terrible things that had happened, and I'd wanted these things to be known. So I was invited to Washington, and there were a lot of people there from, you know, the different services and diplomatic corps. And not only were they interested in what I had seen in terms of the training and the fighting and all of that, but they were very curious as to how Charlie and I had walked 400 miles and how we lived and what we ate and how we knew where we were and all that sort of thing. And I explained all of those things to them, and at the end of that, a couple of people came up to me and said, "We could use a guy like you." And I guess I was sort of a good Boy Scout, and you know, I was not interested really, because I was a journalist, and I thought that would compromise me.
So you said no.
I didn't say no right then. I just never responded.
Mm-hmm. In 1964, you made the movie Nothing But a Man. You were, I believe, the producer and also cinematographer.
Yes, Mike Romer and I made the film together.
Yeah.
We both we wrote the story together, and we produced it together, raised the money together. And I'm also a cameraman, and neither one of us had ever directed actors. Mike directed the actors, and I directed the camera.
Now, Michael Romer's film from a few years after that, The Plot Against Harry, has recently been theatrically released. And in interviews that he's given about that movie, he said that after Nothing But a Man, which was about a black couple in the South, that he felt he had to get closer to his own story, that he felt that you had both missed a lot as white northerners, you know, telling the story of two Southern blacks. So he made a movie about Jews afterwards. I wonder if you ever felt that way, that you needed to get closer to telling your story. Because really throughout your career, you've done so many things that are almost anthropological, both in your documentaries mm-hmm. and even in your fiction films as well.
Well, I have a difference of opinion with Mike on Nothing But a Man. I'm not saying that it's absolutely accurate. It isn't. I don't think there any is any film that is. I'm proud that Nothing But a Man was Malcolm X's favorite movie, and I've met many, many black people who've and other people. I mean, who've come up to me and been very moved and even influenced by that film. So, that's for Mike to that's his feeling about it. I have a very different feeling about it. I'm interested in different people, and it's not as if I don't see myself there too. I'm very attracted to trying to find out about the way other people live and feel, and I empathetically identify with them. So mm-hmm. I don't think I'm a prisoner of who I am. I'm proud of of my background. I think you have to stand in your father's doorway, and then from that place, then you can, knowing who you are, then you can join other people.
Speaking of your father, he was in movies himself. He founded Duart Film Labs, which your brother, I believe, now heads up.
Yes, that's right.
So did you come from a kind of show-busy family at all?
Well, in a way, my uncle, my father's brother was a songwriter and wrote a lot of great songs like How You Gonna Keep Him Down on the Farm After They've Seen Perry and Mammy and I'm Gonna Sit Right Down and Write Myself a Letter, all kinds of wonderful songs.
Wait, what was his name?
5'2". His name was Joe Young.
Oh, okay. So he's the Young on those credits. Okay.
Well, his father's name was Yudovich, but he couldn't. He was born in this. My uncle Joe was born in this country, but his name was Joe Yudovich. He took the first three letters YOU and said the rest was NG. So that's how it became Young. So he really, was the kind of American dream, and the family all became Young. I was born a Young.
Did you intend to start making feature films earlier than you did? I think you were in your 50s by the time you started making theatrical films on a regular basis.
Well, yes. I always was interested in making feature films, but I didn't know how. And I love making movies, and documentaries was tremendously satisfying to me as a young man, because one of the things about documentaries is you really are making the film in a real place, and you're meeting, interesting people. So And you're learning about the world. And when you're young, at least you think you have forever. And just getting experiences was what I was excited about. And I never got tired of that. It's just that in documentaries, it was really hard to get the financing and able to tell the kind of stories I wanted to tell. So when Mike and I made Nothing But a Man, which was our first feature, that was a first chance to be able to really reorder life and tell a story, not just trying to find the story that existed in the world around me. And I felt that the need for fiction. But I also, want to go back to doing documentaries too.
Well, I thank you very much for talking with us about your movies. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Robert Young's new film, Triumph of the Spirit, stars Willem Dafoe and Edward James Olmos and was shot on location at Auschwitz. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, we'll be joined by guitarist and singer Mark Knopfler, leader of the British band Dire Straits. This was their first big hit.
You get a shiver in the dark, it's raining in the park, but meantime, sound of the river, you're stopping, you hold everything. A band is blowing Dixie, double fall time. You feel all right.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Bud Schulberg is best known for writing the screenplay On the Waterfront. He's most controversial for having testified in the early 1950s before the House Un-American Activities Committee. Coming up, we talk with Schulberg about both. Also, rock historian Ed Ward plays the music of Rabbit Brown, one of the best blues musicians you've never heard of. And book critic John Leonard reviews Picturing Will. It's the new novel by Ann Beattie. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Bill Redlin. Communist Party leaders in the Soviet Union ended their second day of fractious debate without resolving key questions about the party's future. Members of the party's Central Committee will meet again in the Kremlin tomorrow to resume discussion of proposals that would end the 70-year-old communist monopoly on political power. Ann Cooper reports from Moscow.
Official transcripts of the closed-door debate portray a leadership in sharp disagreement about how to shape a new Soviet political system. No one spoke openly in opposition to Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev's platform for reform, which would eventually open a path for rival parties. But conservatives complained that Gorbachev has already allowed too much political freedom, and negative forces have used that freedom to create economic and political chaos. Despite the hard line taken by several speakers, liberals say they're optimistic of winning a platform that promises to curb the communist monopoly. If the party doesn't act now, they say, it could face popular protests such as those that toppled Eastern European communists last year. For National Public Radio, I'm Ann Cooper in Moscow.
President Bush says Mr. Gorbachev's political proposals are encouraging, but that the United States should not let changes in Eastern Europe lull us into a sense of complacency. The president offered his remarks to American troops taking part in war games at Fort Irwin, California. Mr. Bush defended his plan to make military cuts in select areas, such as bases, but to spend more on strategic weapons. In East Berlin today, the West German Federal Bank president rejected the idea of an immediate monetary union between East and West Germany. Politicians in both Germanys are pressing the idea as the only solution to the continuing labor drain in East Germany. Deidre Berger reports.
Talks between West German Federal Bank President Karl Otto Pull and the East German State Bank Director Horst Kaminski were confidential, but both men made it clear they did not favor a common currency between the two Germanys. Political pressure has been growing to introduce the strong West German mark as a parallel currency or even substitute currency for the weak East German mark. Both the East and West German chief bankers said after their talks today it was too early to take such a step. West German banker Pull said the East German economy must be restructured before it is even feasible to introduce a new currency. But the bankers' practical objections did not deter politicians today from continuing to press for a monetary and economic union. West German Chancellor Helmut Kohl called for immediate talks between the two countries on the currency problem. For National Public Radio, this is Deidre Berger in West Berlin.
Prices were lower on Wall Street today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell more than 16 points to close at 2606.31. Declines led advances 3-2 in light trading of 134 million shares. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. These days, we often know more than we even want to about the people who make the records we like, their drug habits and political and sexual predilections. But rock and roll historian Ed Ward says every once in a while you can come across a record of beauty performed by someone about whom we know nothing. And Ed says that was the case with Rabbit Brown.
Rabbit Brown was never famous. He was a blues singer who lived and worked in a city, New Orleans, that's known for its music, but not acoustic country blues singers. But one afternoon in 1927, he made a record that haunts most everybody who hears it. Actually, he made five records, and I've managed to find four of them over the years. I've also managed to find out a very few facts about him, from which we can probably infer a couple of other things. One thing I found out, now I can't remember where I read it, was that you could rent Rabbit Brown. Apparently, the way he made his money in the summer was to hang out by the rowboat rentals in City Park, where, for an hourly fee, Rabbit Brown would row out with you in another boat and serenade you.
I don't know what made her be loving me. I was nice, just as nice as I could be. What did she mean by the thing she used to say? She used to tell me sweet stories in a different way. Maybe someone must have took my place. And maybe in a wondrous form, maybe in a charming face. But sure as a star shines above you, oh, Mama, Papa's gonna always love you. Tell me what made you quit loving me.
Like many successful bluesmen, Brown learned vaudeville and pop songs, and I'm Not Jealous, which we just heard, and Never Let the Same Bee Sting You Twice, the record I don't have, are the sort of humorous novelty numbers that appealed to his largely white clientele. They probably also enjoyed hearing ballads. The kidnapping he sings about in The Mystery of the Dunbar Child was 15 years old by the time he recorded it, but it's still news today.
You know the two children, they wandered off. Bobby and his Conrad alone. When the returning of the other child, he just said, oh, Bobby's gone. But where did little Bobby go? Everyone like to know. And they all start searching out for Lucifer and along Lake the way the show.
He used the same tune for his version of The Sinking of the Titanic, a big favorite with black singers because of the unfounded rumor that a wealthy black man had been denied passage on the doomed boat by a skipper who said, I don't haul coal. The prospect of all those rich white men drowning among the icebergs was too good to miss, though, and Brown interpolates the hymn Nearer My God to Thee in his recording, singing it with relish.
The music played as they went down on that dark blue sea. And you could hear the sound, that familiar hymn, singing nearer, oh my God, to thee. If it's nearer, oh my God, to thee. Nearer, my God, tell thee. Nearer, oh my God, to thee.
What we've heard so far of Rabbit Brown has been unexceptional. To be honest, he probably was pretty unexceptional himself. He was probably getting on in years, and in a jazz-mad town like New Orleans, he was an anachronism. But he had one song left in him, a song of barely suppressed anger at the way the world had treated him, a song that ends with one of the most bone-chilling verses I've ever heard. Ladies and gentlemen, Richard Rabbit Brown and James Alley Blues.
Don't find me now, nothing like it used to be. No time seems now, nothing like it used to be. And I'm telling you all the truth, oh, take it for me. I haven't seen better days, but I'm putting up with thee. I haven't seen better days, but I'm putting up with thee. I could have a much better time, but these girls now it's so hard to please. Cause I was born in the country, and I needed to rule. Cause I was born in the country, she thinks I'm easy to rule. She tried to hitch me to a wagon, she wanna drive me like a mule. You know, I bought the groceries. And I pay the rent. Yeah, I buy the groceries. And I pay the rent. She tried to make me wash her clothes, but I got good common sense. I said, if you don't want me, why don't you tell me so? You know that if you don't want me, why don't you tell me so? Because it ain't like a man that ain't got nowhere to go. I've been giving you sugar for sugar, let you get salt for salt. I'll give you sugar for sugar, let you get salt for salt. And if you can't get along with me, well, it's your own fault. How you want me to love you and you treat me mean? How do you want me to love you? You keep on treating me mean. You're my daily thought and my nightly dream. Sometimes I think that you're too sweet to die. Sometimes I think that you're too sweet to die. And another time I think you ought to be buried alive.
James Alley Blues by Richard Rabbit Brown, which I found on the Folkways Anthology of American Folk Music. Just about all I know about Richard Rabbit Brown.
Ed Ward writes for the Austin Chronicle. This is Fresh Air. My guest, Bud Schulberg, wrote one of the most memorable scenes in film history.
You was my brother, Charlie. You should have looked out for me a little bit. You should have taken care of me just a little bit so I wouldn't have to take them dives for the short end money.
Oh, I had some bets down for you. You saw some money.
You don't understand. I could have had class. I could have been a contender. I could have been somebody instead of a bum, which is what I am. Let's face it.
On the Waterfront starred Marlon Brando as a boxer-turned-dock worker who risks his life to testify against the mobsters who control his union. Some critics interpreted the movie as the filmmaker's rationalization for informing. Schulberg and Waterfront's director, Ilya Kazan, both testified and named names to the House Un-American Activities Committee in the early 50s. Schulberg was a member of the Communist Party in the late 30s. Schulberg's other screenplays include The Harder They Fall and A Face in the Crowd, but he first became known for his novel, What Makes Sammy Run, about a movie producer who ruthlessly pushes his way to the top. A 50th anniversary edition has just been published. Schulberg started writing the story in college, but he grew up in the movie industry.
My father ran a big studio, Paramount Studio, and we went out there when I was about 4 years old. And so I was sort of raised on the back lot, and I was raised in story conferences. And so this was all around me all the time, till I went east to college.
When What Makes Sammy Run was published, what was the reaction in the film industry like? I mean, you had created a film producer in Sammy Glick who was egomaniacal, who would step on anybody to get ahead, who was totally lacking in ethics. This was obviously modeled on people who you knew in the film industry. So what was the reaction like in the industry?
It was not gentle, I would say. I came back, I hit out just the opposite of what we do now as we go around, as we publish our books. And when I came back from Mexico, where I was when the book came out, I walked in a restaurant, big restaurant like Romanoff's, which was the restaurant, or Chasen's, and the reaction was so it was not quite violent, but it was so strong that I would say that many people just shunned me, turned their backs on me, and wouldn't talk to me. It was a very clear reaction to the resentment that I would write a book that would be in any way critical of Hollywood.
Did it make it hard for you as a young screenwriter to get work?
Well, I was prepared for that in advance because my father, when he read the manuscript, wrote to me. I wrote the book back at my college, Dartmouth, and my father, when he read the manuscript before the book came out, said, "Bud, if you publish this book, don't you realize?" I'm laughing, but he said, you'll never work here again. You'll be finished. And he asked me how will I live? I guess worried that he might have to support me. And I knew that there would be anger. And I knew that L.B. Mayer, who's the second M in MGM, I knew that Louis Mayer, who had been my father's partner once, would be furious at me. I was ready for all that.
I want to skip ahead with you to the 1950s. Now, you teamed up with Ilya Kazan to do On the Waterfront after you had both testified to the House Un-American Activities Committee. He said in his memoirs that he felt that there was a bond of understanding between the two of you because you'd both been through that. Did you feel that way?
Well, I felt our bond of understanding began when nobody in Hollywood would do On the Waterfront, when every major studio turned down On the Waterfront, which I think they should remember, and that Kazan, when I was irritated about it, Kazan said to me, "Bud, I want to make this movie. If I have to take a handheld camera and go down on the docks myself, I'm going to make this movie." I think that's where the bond began. As for the testimony, although it is true that we were both what they call friendly witnesses before that committee, I reject the theory that the ending of that picture or the fact that Terry Molloy testifies was related that closely to us. I spent about a year and a half on the waterfront. I really loved the Rebel Longshoreman. I saw Father John Corydon go through hell, even with his superiors, and he was...
This is the priest that the Carl Malden character.
That's right.
Was
he was
on.
Really... Father Barry was really... Father Barry in the movie was patterned directly on this waterfront priest. And I saw Father John or Father Barry in the movie urging these men to get up and testify at the waterfront crime hearings. And I attended them every day. They went for about 5 or 6 weeks. And I spoke to Kazan about it, looking for the ending of our film. And I said, "Gaj, I think we have found the ending for our film, because these men are saying, 'My God, if I get up and do that, you know what's going to happen. I'll be in the North River.' That's what they call the Hudson River. I'll be gone." And that was the real source of the ending of that picture. It really was not the fact that we were saying, "How can we get back at these people?" I've had some disagreement with Kazan about that. He could say, and I'll make this very brief, that maybe that intensified his ability to direct that scene, or that it gave him some additional emotion, but I never thought of it in writing it, and I was the writer of it.
When you were called to the House Un-American Activities Committee, why did you decide to name names and to testify?
For one reason, because I was no longer under communist discipline, and because all of those people who they now say took the fifth, which is that I refused to testify on the grounds that it will incriminate me, I could not see how I could say that. I couldn't get my mouth around that would incriminate me.
Have you ever had regrets or second thoughts about testifying?
Not really, no. No, I haven't, because I don't see what the only alternative for me was to seem to be on the side of the communists. And if you ever saw V.J. Jerome, a commissar for cultural affairs, who tells you that you can't write the book unless it's checked over by this or that or the other, I felt the American people had a right to know that.
in spite of the evils perpetrated in the name of communism at the time that you were testifying, did you ever feel that you were participating in what was practically a witch hunt in America that was having a devastating effect on the lives of the people being pursued?
I thought two things. I thought it should have been done more carefully, but I thought that the people who were fighting here and calling it a witch hunt should have realized that if they are against a blacklist, that they should also involve themselves in the fight against the death list, and that while writers may be better than any of us were being killed in the Soviet Union, they seem to have absolutely no interest in that.
I want to ask you, I know that you have, you've had a stutter on and off through your life, and I wonder how that's affected how you've dealt with Hollywood, and I mean that in the sense that I know so much about Hollywood is about, like, pitching the script and making the deal, and there's all this fast talk, I assume, that goes on, and how comfortable you felt with that.
I've never been crazy about the story conferences. I remember Bill Faulkner, William Faulkner worked out in Hollywood a good deal more than people realize. And one time they had one of these meetings that you're describing, and they're saying, now, the boy and girl have to meet cute and fast, and how can we show right away, instantly, that they are closely related? And they were throwing, and all people, and a lot of the fast talkers were ad-libbing meet cute ideas. And Faulkner, who was rather withdrawn, extremely withdrawn, wrote a note, and he handed it to a friend of mine, and my friend told me about it right after the meeting, and the note said, what if they were brother and sister? So, to answer your question, I guess there are some people who can get up there and pitch, and there are others who can get up to bat without saying much and hit a home run.
Okay, well, I thank you very much for talking with us. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
A 50th anniversary edition of Bud Schulberg's novel, What Makes Sammy Run, has just been published by Random House, along with a collection of his short stories called Love, Action, Laughter, and Other Sad Tales. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer is with us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda, yesterday Gorbachev called for a multi-party system. What's the story from the Soviet Union today?
Well, he dropped a bombshell, and the debate is still going on. In fact, the discussions will be extended for one more day. And on the other side of the world, in South Africa, the debate of democracy is going on there, too, where there's increasing pressure being put on the government to move to a one-person, one-vote system. Back in the United States, Terry, we're going to take another look at base closings. We'll have a report from Texas, where a base closing and conversion operation isn't working, and one from Michigan, where it is.
Thanks, Linda. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Picturing Will is a new novel by Ann Beattie. Book critic John Leonard has this review.
I used to think that Ann Beattie was a sort of Samuel Beckett, only young and female. Somehow premature in knowing so much and feeling so bad. A wizened baby skin. In her first story collections, and then again in her first novel, Chilly Scenes of Winter, children of the 1960s, unfinished and spaced out, were trying to be adults in the 1970s, where real life and disposable style seemed never to come into a reasonable approximation, never quite to fit. Wherever they happened to be, these characters had arrived by accident, by juxtaposition, by somebody else's gravity. They had strong feelings, but weak attachments. And they were looked at by a cool customer who seemed to be saying that out of this randomness, this surprise, this mystery, we invent our future against our will. Maybe tired of hearing that she was the voice of a minimalist generation, Beatty, in her next novel, Falling in Place, was every bit as knowing about families as an Updike, with some of Cheever's lyric mournfulness. In this postmodern fairy tale, people wear crash helmets because they don't know where Skylab will fall down. A magician with foam rubber rabbits and dead flowers haunts the laundromat. A man named Spangle, tossing a key into a Spanish fountain, is asked what he wishes for. "I don't know," he says. "The usual, I guess." Maybe tired of being told to lighten up, Beatty in her third novel, Love Always, was hilarious. Jane Austen instead of Samuel Beckett. In her fourth novel, Picturing Will, she seems to have dreamed an entire book from a single exchange in Falling in Place, in which a failed husband and a failed father realizes that he's married the wrong person and had the wrong children. A friend tells him that the real killer is when you marry the wrong person but have the right children. Beatty's inside a 5-year-old boy, or is she? Certainly we're asked to see the world through young Will's eyes as he discovers sexuality and abandonment, friendship and betrayal. We're also asked to see through the eyes of his mother, Jody, a photographer about to graduate from taking snapshots of weddings in Charlottesville, Virginia, to the big-time New York art market. And through the eyes of Will's father, working on his third wife in Florida. And through the eyes of Mel, who befriends Will to win his mother's love. Throughout the novel, there are long italic passages, meditations on child-raising, which we presume to be his mother's. Finally, a grown-up Will finds out who really loved him all along. Who tells him, "Though I have done other things through the years, I still think of myself as the person who knelt so many times to tie your shoelaces, who needed to see them double-knotted and to know that you were safe again from tripping. I could have identified your feet, and still could I see them so clearly, in a lineup of 100 children." If I tiptoe around this synopsis, it's because a narrative trick is involved. It's a detective story. Find the parent. All I'll say is that after the little essays on photography and art, the clever New York parties and dazzling Florida sunsets, the pre-dawn walks and swimming pool sex, so many nuances, so much flourish, Beatty nailed me. So we're neither of us heartless after all. I fell on her passion as if on a sword.
Jen Leonard writes about television for New York Magazine. He's a columnist for New York Newsday and media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed Picturing Will by Ann Beatty. Our reviews and commentaries are produced by Naomi Person, with assistance from Joan Tuohy and Roberta Shurrock. Joyce Lieberman is our technical director. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we meet guitarist Mark Knopfler, the leader of the British rock group Dire Straits. Also, actress Laurie Metcalf. On TV, she plays Roseanne's sister, who just became a cop. She's also a cop in the new film Internal Affairs. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.